Jan Sharoot,
Zuga bellowed down the shaft.
A little cave.
Jan Sharoot's voice was muffled and distorted by the echoes.
I can just stand. The reef is black with soot.
Cooking fires. The slaves would have been kept down there. Zuga guessed this. Never seeing the light of day until they died. Then he raised his voice.
What else?
Ropes. Plaited grass ropes and buckets. Leather buckets like we used on the diamond diggings at New Rush.
Jan Sharoot broke off with an exclamation.
They fall to pieces when I touch them.
Just dust now. Faintly they could hear Jan Sharoot sneezing and coughing in the dust he had raised, and his voice was thickened and nasal as he went on.
Iron tools, something like a hatchet.
And when he called again, they could hear the tremor in his voice.
Name of the great snake. There are dead men here. Dead men's bones. I'm coming up. Pull me up.
Staring down the narrow shaft, Ralph could see the light of the candle flame wavering and trembling at the bottom.
Jan Sharoot, is there a tunnel leading off from the cave?
Pull me up.
Can you see a tunnel?
Yes, now will you please pull me up?
Not until you follow the tunnel to the end.
Are you mad? I would have to crawl on hands and knees.
Take one of the iron tools with you to break off a piece of reef.
No, that's far enough. I'll go no further, not with dead men guarding this place.
Very well, Ralph bellowed into the hole. Then I will throw the end of the rope down on top of you.
You would not do that.
After that, I will put the rocks back over the entrance.
I'm going!
Jan Sharoot's voice had a desperate edge. And once again the rope began slithering down into the shaft, like a serpent into its nest. Ralph and Zuga squatted beside the shaft, passing their last cheroot back and forth, and waiting with ill grace and impatience. When they deserted these workings, they must have sealed the slaves in the shaft. A slave was a valuable chattel, so that proves they were still working the reef, and that they left in great haste. Zuga paused, cocked his head to listen, and then said, "Ah!" with satisfaction. From the depths of the earth at their feet came the distinct clank of metal tool on living rock.
Jan Sharoot has reached the workface.
However, it was many minutes more before they saw the wavering candlelight in the bottom of the pit again, and Jan Sharoot's pleas, quavering and pitiful, came up to them.
"Please, Master Ralph, I've done it. Now will you pull me up, please?"
Ralph stood with one booted foot on each side of the shaft and hauled in the rope hand over hand. The muscles of his arms bulged and subsided under the sleeves of his thin cotton shirt as he lifted the Hottentot and his burden to the surface without a pause. And when he had finished, Ralph's breathing was still even and quiet, and there was not a single bead of perspiration on his face.
"So, Jan Sharoot, what did you find?"
Jan Sharoot was coated all over with fine pale dust, through which his sweat had cut muddy runnels, and he stank of bat guano and the mushroom odour of long deserted caves. With hands that still shook with fear and exhaustion, he opened the flap of the saddlebag at his waist.
"This is what I found,"
he croaked, and Zuga took a lump of the raw, rough rock from him. It had a crystalline texture that glittered like ice, and was marbled with blue, and riven by minute flaws and fissures, some of which had cracked through under the pounding of the iron adze with which Jan Sharoot had hacked it from the rock face. However, the shattered fragments of shining quartz were held together by the substance that had filled every crack and fault line in the ore. This cement was a thin, malleable layer of bright metal that twinkled in the sunlight when Zuga wet it with the tip of his tongue.
"By God, Ralph, will you look at that?"
And Ralph took it from his father's hand with the reverence of a worshipper receiving the sacrament.
"Gold," he whispered,
and it sparkled at him, that lovely yellow smile that had captivated men almost from the time they had first stood upon their hind legs.
"Gold,"
Ralph repeated. to find this glimmer of precious metal. They had laboured most of their lives, father and son. They had ridden far, and in the company of other freebooters had fought bloody battles and helped destroy a proud nation and hunt a king to a lonely death. Led by a sick man with swollen, crippled heart and grandiose dreams, they had seized a vast land that now bore that giant's name, Rhodesia, and they had forced the land to yield up, one by one, its riches. They had taken its wide, sweet pastures and lovely mountain ranges, its forests of fine native timber, its herds of sleek cattle, its legions of sturdy black men, who for a pittance would provide the thews to gather in the vast harvest. And now at last they held the ultimate treasure in their hands. "Gold," Ralph said for the third time. They struck their pegs along the ridge, cutting them from the living acacia trees that oozed clear sap from the axe cuts, and they hammered them into the hard earth with the flat of the blade. Then they built cairns of stone to mark the corner of each claim. Under the Fort Victoria agreement, which both of them had signed when they volunteered to ride against Lobengula's impis, they were each entitled to 10 gold claims. This naturally did not apply to Yun Shirut. Despite the fact that he had ridden into Matabele land with Jamison's flying column and shot down the Matabele Amadoda at the Shangani River and the Bembezi crossing with as much gusto as had his masters, yet he was a man of colour, and as such he could not share the spoils. In addition to the booty to which Zuga and Ralph were entitled under the Victoria Agreement, both of them had bought up many blocks of claims from the dissolute and spendthrift troopers of Jamison's conquering force, some of whom had sold for the price of a bottle of whisky. So between them they could peg off the entire ridge and most of the valley bottoms on each side of it. It was hard work, but urgent, for there were other prospectors abroad, one of whom could have followed their tracks. They worked through the heat of noon, and by the light of the moon, until sheer exhaustion forced them to drop their axes and sleep where they fell. On the fourth evening they could stop at last, content that they had secured the entire reef for themselves. There was no gap between their pegs into which another prospector could jump.
"Yun Shirut, there is only one bottle of whisky left," Zuga groaned and stretched his aching shoulders. "But tonight I am going to let you pour your own dop."
They watched with amusement the elaborate precautions which Yun Shirut took to get the last drop into his brimming mug. In the process, the line around the bottom that marked his daily grog ration was entirely ignored. And when the mug was full, he did not trust the steadiness of his own hand, but slurped up the first mouthful on all fours like a dog. Ralph retrieved the bottle and ruefully considered the remnants of the liquor before pouring a dram for his father and himself.
"The Harkness mine,"
Zuga gave them the toast.
"Why do you call it that?"
Ralph demanded when he lowered his mug and wiped his moustache with the back of his hand.
"Old Tom Harkness gave me the map that led me to it," Zuga replied.
"Oh, we could find a better name."
"Perhaps, but that's the one I want."
"The gold will be just as bright, I expect," Ralph capitulated, and carefully moved the whisky bottle out of the little Hottentot's reach, for Yun Shirut had drained his mug already.
"I'm glad we're doing something together again, Papa." Ralph settled down luxuriously against his saddle.
"Yes," Zuga agreed softly. "It's been too long since we worked side by side in the diamond pit at New Rush."
"I know just the right fellow to open up the workings for us. He's a top man, the best on the Witwatersrand goldfields, and I'll have my wagons bringing up the machinery before the rains break."
It was part of their agreement that Ralph would provide the men and machinery and money to run the Harkness mine when Zuga led him to it. For Ralph was a rich man. Some said he was already a millionaire, though Zuga knew that was unlikely. Nevertheless, Zuga remembered that Ralph had provided the transport and commissariat for both the Mashonaland column and the Matabeleland expedition against Lobengula, and for each he had been paid huge sums by Mr. Rhodes's British South Africa Company, not in cash, but in company shares. Like Zuger himself, he had speculated by buying up original land grants from the thriftless drifters that made up the bulk of the original column, and had paid them in whiskey, carried up from the railhead in his own wagons. Ralph's Rhodesia Land Company owned more land than did even Zuger himself. Ralph had also speculated in the shares of the British South Africa Company. In those heady days when the column first reached Fort Salisbury, he had sold shares that Mr. Rhodes had issued to him at £1 for the sum of £3.15 on the London stock market. Then, when the pioneer's vaunting hopes and optimism had withered on the sour felt and barren ore bodies of Mashonaland, and Rhodes and Jamieson were secretly planning their war against the Matabele King, Ralph had repurchased British South Africans at 8 shillings. He had then seen them quoted at £8 when the column rode into the burning ruins of Lobengula's kraal at Gubuluwayo, and the company had added the entire realm of the Matabele monarch to its possessions. Now, listening to his son talk with that infectious energy and charisma, which even those hard days and nights of physical labour on the claims could not dull, Zuger reflected that Ralph had laid the telegraph lines from Kimberley to Fort Salisbury, that his construction gangs were at this moment laying the railway lines across the same wilderness towards Bulawayo, that his 200 wagons carried trade goods to more than 100 of Ralph's own trading posts scattered across Bechuanaland and Matabeleland and Mashonaland, that as of today, Ralph was a half-owner of a gold mine that promised to be as rich as any of the fabulous Witwatersrand. Zuger smiled to himself as he listened to Ralph talk in the flickering firelight, and he thought suddenly, damn it! But they might be right after all. The puppy might just possibly be a millionaire already. And his pride was tinged with envy. Zuger himself had worked and dreamed from long before Ralph was born, had made sacrifice and had suffered hardships that still made him shudder when he thought about them, all for much lesser reward. Apart from this new reef, all he had to show for a lifetime of striving was King's Lynn and Louise. And then he smiled. With those two possessions, he was richer than Mr. Rhodes would ever be. Zuger sighed and tilted his hat forward over his eyes. And with Louise's beloved face held firmly in the eye of his mind, he drifted into sleep. While across the fire, Ralph still talked quietly, for himself more than his father, and conjured up new visions of wealth and power. It was 2 full days' ride back to the wagons, but they were still 1/2 mile from the camp when they were spotted, and a joyous tide of servants and children and dogs and wives came clamouring out to greet them. Ralph spurred forward and leaned low from the saddle to sweep Cathy up into the pommel so violently that her hair tumbled into her face, and she shrieked breathlessly until he silenced her with a kiss full on the mouth, and he held the kiss unashamedly, while little Jonathan danced impatiently around the horse, shouting, "Me too! Lift me up too, Papa!"